Life is made up of decisions. Some are large, some are small, and some are uniquely individual, and some are thrust upon us. Either way, the decisions we make at these critical crossroads determine the direction of our life story. Welcome to our podcast, If I Knew Then What I Know Now, Insights Through the Rearview Mirror. By sharing the decision-making process of highly successful people in their own lives, and what they have learned both about decision-making and the importance of considering the alternatives, we hope to help you make better and more productive decisions in your life. This podcast will help you consider all your decisions through a new lens. My name is John Kramer, and along with my partner in crime, my brother Paul, we will interview a wide range of successful friends and acquaintances to understand the decisions they have made in life, and what they have learned both about decision-making and the importance of reflecting on the process. If I Knew Then What I Know Now, Insights Through the Rearview Mirror, is brought to you by Industry Intelligence, providing decision-making solutions at your fingertips. Welcome to If I Knew Then What I Know Now, Insights Through the Rearview Mirror. I'm today's host, John Kramer, and as we continue our exploration of the decision-making process, those of you following our show through engaging conversations with friends and acquaintances, we're committed to helping listeners make better, more informed decisions. Through these discussions, we explore frameworks and constructs that they use and that you, in turn, can use to make better decisions in your own life. Although we're constantly making decisions, many of us either don't have a decision-making go-to construct or don't take the time and, as a result, make important life decisions in a vacuum. Not small decisions like what shirt should I wear today, but life-defining decisions such as should I change jobs or even a career or move to a new community, state, or country. However, these decisions make up the arc of our lives and dictate the direction we steer our futures. I'm excited that today we'll be joined by John Bowman, who for over 45 years has served as a public interest lawyer in both Chicago and nationally. John recently retired from the Shriver Center on Poverty Law after 24 years as director and president. Among his many honors, he's received the Kodak Dodds Prize for the National Legal Aid and Defender Association and Child Healthcare Advocate Award from the American Academy of Pediatrics. John, welcome to our show. Over the years, beginning with your graduation from law school, you've made some pretty big defining life decisions. In keeping with our listener promise, do you have a construct that you use when making big decisions?
When you sent me that question, it caused me to think about it. And I realized that I do have a process. I didn't think of it as such, but I do have one. And it has evolved over time as I've gotten more conscious about it. Back when I was in law school, part of what was going on there was just sort of delaying what I would do when I grew up. Staying in school three more years. But what it did was it got me on a path. And I realized that the decision I was making, not just to go into law, but to go into public interest law, was consistent with my upbringing and the things that the role models I had, all of which were mostly sort of clergy and people in the church. I didn't want to do that, but everybody I looked up to, their professional life was about a mission, about accomplishing, moving the ball forward on important things related to our values, and that taking action to do that was what I wanted to do. And the role of public interest law was just emerging then out of the war on poverty, and that was the career I wanted to do, and it was where I thought I could be both happy and productive. In that sense of working towards a mission as opposed to working towards a particular dollar goal or that kind of goal.
You know, it's
being consistent with that kind of internal motivation, I think, was an important part of that decision making process.
Let me probe that for a minute, because what I heard you say is that you graduated from college. You didn't want to go into real life, so you figured you'd go to law school. I'll take three more years and not deal with life. I didn't pick law because I wanted to solve the problems of the world. I just wanted three more years of school.
Well, it was kind of both, but yes, basically.
And then also in thinking about that, and what's interesting to me is that we've been speaking to a lot of people, and we hear this focus on faith as a anchor to a decision making process, as a window into the decision making process. And what I heard you say is that when you look back over the people that you respected in life, and you look back over the people that sort of steered the direction of your life, it was very much around faith. Is that an accurate conclusion?
Yeah, that's accurate. That's accurate. So,
all right. So you took your 3 more years of school, and you graduated from law school, and you really had the ability at that point to go in many directions. And it's interesting, you and I are about the same age. And when I graduated from college, law school was certainly one of the things that I considered. My grades were not quite consistent with those that went to law school, so I ended up going into advertising. But you had the whole world in front of you after law school. And one of the things that certainly appealed to me about going into law was the opportunity to make a lot of money. What led you into advocacy, and what was the thought process that took you there?
Well, it's actually why I went to law school. Among the things that would prolong the specific decision about a career and so on, was the thought that to do something, to equip yourself to do something to promote justice and to help people who needed help. I wasn't terribly organized about that thinking, but that was what I was there to do. And as law school progressed and you could see the accumulation of the tools of a kind of power that you actually could make things happen, you could be of help, that by the time I got out of law school, I actually did not approach it as a choice between different kinds of law careers, but I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and it was this public interest work. And you know, it was the sort of linear. The nice thing about law school, it was different from undergraduate, where it was just kind of taking courses. Law school was much more linear, and it was a path to acquiring both the license and the skill set to actually make a difference like that. And you know, in those days, it was Vietnam, it was war on poverty, it was the civil rights movement, and so on. There was a lot of idealism on campuses and a lot of, you know, stick it to the manism and things like that, that appealed to me at that time. And so this was, you know, it was not a kind of fork in the road after law school. It was, a boost further down a road I was already on.
So in the early years after you graduated, you established yourself as a staff attorney at the largest legal aid program in Chicago. And you were in a high volume storefront practice.
Right.
So when you came out of law school, there probably were a number of options in terms of the kinds of law firm you joined, even though it was advocacy. Was there a decision? I mean, it's sort of interesting to me. My vision of a storefront practice is, you know, you sitting at a desk and people walking in and out of the front door saying, oh, I got a problem. I need a solution. I can't afford it. I need help. So, you know, there's sort of an interesting perspective there. Is that okay? I can go join a law firm and do some advocacy work in a palette of a lot of different kinds of work. Or here I'm gonna be in a storefront. I'm gonna sit in a storefront. And I'm gonna wait for people to come in. How did you make that decision? And how did you come to this? And did your decision making construct work within that?
Yeah, well, and that was when I started to grow an actual decision-making kind of frame, right? There's two kinds of decisions that we're talking about here, I think. One is, you know, career-type decisions, life-type decisions. Mm-hmm. The other are the decisions you make within your sort of profession, uh-huh. Right? So the split-second decisions you have to make when you're in a trial in a courtroom or in a hearing for someone. So the sort of tactical stuff you have to do, and to do that in an organized way, in a way that gets, you know, gets the victory for your client. And the other is sort of career directions. So one of the things, it wasn't a matter of subject matter so much when I started, it was this choice between two different kinds of very good rewarding work. One is to continue to represent those individuals in high volume matters, you know, an eviction, bill collection, civil rights, you know, somebody got fired because they were Black, that kind of thing. Or do you want to go farther upstream and address root causes and do more complex things that had a, you know, that could change actual laws and policies and systems? They're both valuable things. The place I worked, and one of the reasons I wanted to work there, was because they encouraged the lawyers to do both. And that after a few years, then you could decide to, you know, stay with the high volume practice, or having gotten that experience, then to move into more of a focus on the systemic type work. In those days, we called it law reform work. And, you know, so that was kind of the choice that I gradually made about where I wanted to go with my career. Is, you know, I wanted to be on that bigger stage. It's not more worthy, it's just different type of work and a different kind of set of things that you can accomplish.
My judgment would be, correct me if I'm wrong, but this whole idea of law reform work is a lot more, let me call it, just from my perspective, frustrating than doing more, okay, I got a problem, here's a solution. Because I have found myself screaming at the television set over the last number of years about, you know, how people respond to questions and policies and those kinds of things. Why can't you do, how are you thinking through this? So you really fought tirelessly for human rights as you went into more law reform. And among your many accomplishments was creating the Family Care Program, which provides health care insurance for over 400,000 working poor parents of minor children and kids. And this was the first, this, as we looked at it, this was the first state plan to extend health coverage to every child, regardless of their immigration status. And I would assume that you had to fight the state government on this. And can you sort of talk us through the thinking about how you approach this decisions and the arguments you made? Right. Because decisions are not only about life decisions, it's also a construct in terms of, okay, I got this problem. I got the government I'm dealing with, which is, you know, about as hard to change direction as it is to move Mount Everest. How do I deal with this?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's a very good example about sort of decision making. So one of, and there's a couple things in there. One of them is to sort of make sure you have the information you need, right? And that you have a good, vigorous conversation with colleagues, right? There's nothing more enjoyable and also more rewarding and conducive to good decisions than having a vigorous back and forth with colleagues who have permission from each other to put ideas out there and also have them batted down. And work your way towards good decisions. And so that was part of this the whole time. We noticed that, you know, welfare reform happened in the late 90s. And one of the things, and it was not a happy thing for poor people. It was a conservative revolution. It eliminated the basic right for poor children and mothers to have some sort of cash subsistence safety net. It eliminated that. It was a bad moment for people representing the poor in 1996. But one of the silver linings there, if you understood it well, and if you had all the information, was that states could actually expand health coverage for the working poor. Which would be a vast improvement from previous times. You had to sort of swim through the unfortunate things about that law to see this opportunity. And so the states could do that with substantial federal support, but they had to be talked into it. So it was not like going to court and being coercive and getting a court order and forcing people to do things. It was, you had to talk them into wanting to do it. So we had to put together a process with Republicans and Democrats to move towards this expansion of coverage for working poor adults. And so we also had to make up your mind that it was going to be a multi-year process. The decision-making pieces of that, first of all, the sort of vigorous conversation and good colleagues and making sure you've sort of tested the ideas as you move forward. But secondly, also then when you see the opening and you know where it is to act on it, right? To not just be in contemplation, but at some point you have to transfer into action. The third thing is patience and willing to surf through the ups and downs and keep it on a forward trajectory. And then the last thing I would say is to understand to take a step back and look at the big picture, particularly in moments of disappointment. So we put forth a big, big effort on this, huge public rallies, you know, a very strong lobbying effort, a lot of media around getting this bill passed to do this expansion. And got right up to the end. We moved it way far down from no support at all to strong majority support in both chambers. But it was just, and then in the last week of the session, the support of the governor even, but it was too late and the bill didn't pass because the leadership wouldn't call it. And it was just this huge deflating moment. And if that had been it, and we'd have gone home and licked our wounds and complained about it, that we would have missed an opportunity. Because when you took a step back and looked at it and looked how far it had come and the huge momentum we'd built that continued to reverberate and to make this thing politically important, sure enough, by later in that year, the governor had taken action to do things with executive power. And the following year, it passed the legislature in a non-controversial bipartisan vote. So part of decision-making and part of leadership is to maintain that focus and to figure out the next steps to do, but to stay in motion and to, you know, to continue to be devoted to taking action at, you know, crucial moments.
So, you know, we try to really focus our discussions here as much as possible on this decision-making construct. And we've really talked to a lot of different people and heard a lot of different approaches, everything from making lists to looking at their faith. And, you know, one of the things we heard is that we look at objective strategies and tactics, and we've got an objective and we are going to drive against that objective, and the strategies might change, but we want to make changes. And I hear you saying over and over again, as we're having this conversation, that, you know, once you get your objectives in line, that you focus on those objectives and drive against those objectives. And no matter what barriers are thrown in your place, you work through those objectives. And I guess the question I have is that you've been speaking a lot about internally, you know, sitting down with your colleagues and sort of discussing and debating how to approach a issue or a challenge. But then there's a whole different group of people you got to talk to, which is externally, you know, whether it's the government or whether it's a jury, whatever it is, and you need to sort of talk them through and understand, help them understand what you're trying to achieve. And those are, to me, when I think about the law, probably the most important types of decisions. And I'm always been interested, since I never did get that chance to go to law school, is there some sort of a process that they teach you or that you come to on your own to say, okay, here is the how I am going to solve decisions. Here's how I am gonna create a roadmap to get to my adversaries, and whether those adversaries are jurists or whether those adversaries are the government, to work with me on making the right decision. Is there a process?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And so in the context of a lawsuit, for example, or litigation, you have to, and this is how the sort of internal process with your colleagues feeds the decisions you make in the outside process with the people you have to convince. Because what you first have to understand is what are the elements, they call it, the sort of, what are the things we have to prove? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and therefore 6, right? And that you keep those in mind. That's how you structure the whole thing, right? And how you work your way through the thickets of distractions and emotions and surprises is that you keep your focus on that North Star of these are the things we have to prove to get to the goal we want. And you see in there, okay, we've got this evidence to do number one. We're good on 2 and 3. Number four is kind of a he said, she said. So that's going to be the focus of the trial. We got to convince them to believe our side of this thing because we don't have a slam dunk evidence on it. And then number five is covered and therefore 6. So you realize where the soft spot is that one thing. And so you sort of organize the advocacy and decision making around getting that done. But the idea is to stay focused, to not follow blind alleys, to not get taken on emotional trips, to try and stay in control of that whole thing all through the discovery and the procedural wrangling and the, personal foibles of the opponent and to get to that end. There's a similar process, I think, with a policy advocacy that isn't in court. The people in the organizing profession call it a power analysis, where you look at, okay, who can do this? Who out there? Is it a governor? Is it the legislature? Is it mayor? Who's got the power to do what you want done? And then how do you get to them? How do you get them to do that? Either influence them, persuade them, force them. How do you get them to do it? So a lot of it is about sort of building roll calls or getting a persuadable person to do something. But that teaches you how, okay, if we're going to form alliances out there, if we're going to approach people, think about who we need to approach because that person with the power listens to them or is afraid of them and so it's that kind of, it puts a structure on it. And then you sort of marshal the there's different strands of work, right? There's the expertise that you need. There's the strategic, the good sort of lobbying, seasoned lobbyist thing you need. There's research that you need. There's organizing to do. There's talking clergy people into supporting it. There's these strands of work. And so you organize a campaign around bringing those strands of work together for crescendo moments, like the filing of a bill, the hearing in committee, the floor vote. You're able to focus those things on those crescendo moments. And then when that moment is done, you evaluate it, you reorganize, and you point it all towards the next moment.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that a decision-making construct or process that's something we have not heard from many of our discussions is starting with the end in mind. And, oh, and yeah. That's what I hear you say.
You reverse engineer from there.
Exactly. Absolutely. That's what I hear you say.
Today, more than ever, you need to find the right information quickly and easily. Weeding through everything available is like drinking through a fire hose. Industry intelligence is like having your very own research assistant. The first place I go when I need to access data and insights for a client project or a new business solicitation is industry intelligence. Using their powerful patented technology and unique approach to information gathering, curation, and editing, they put everything I need in one place and serve it up in a user-friendly interface. Why not put a data and insight solution partner at your fingertips? For more information, call Chuck Bolcom at 920-891-5496. That's 920-891-5496. And now, for Rearview Mirror listeners, Industry Intelligence is providing a special offer, a 30-day trial membership, absolutely free, when you mention our podcast. So give Chuck a call today. Tell him you're looking for a way to make better decisions. Industry Intelligence, decision-making solutions at your fingertips.
So I think coming out of this conversation is sort of a new idea of starting with the end in mind and then working backwards to see how you get to that end.
Yeah, and it's kind of what strategic planning is. If you're talking about an organizational trajectory, right, is you say, okay, let's look 5 years out and say, what does success look like then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. Once we decide that, then, okay, let's come back to now and figure out how we get there. When we started the Schreiber Center in 1996, it was a child of a complete disaster and crisis. The federal government had restricted the funding for legal services to the poor so that you could not do what we called law reform earlier in the conversation. You couldn't do class action lawsuits. You couldn't do lobbying. You couldn't do organizing. You couldn't do welfare reform, which was happening right then. And my view, poor people in Illinois needed that kind of representation just as much as they needed it in their divorce or their eviction or whatever. And so in order to do that work, we had to start a new organization and do it without any government money. And basically that was the birth story of the Shriver Center. It was, I had two little kids, mortgage, and if there was no guarantee this was going to work. So it was like you had to make a bet on yourself, right? If it doesn't work, that's okay. I'll land on my feet kind of thing. And the people who worked with me followed along and we did it. We made it go. There's a lot of, that whole process was a story about trying to make decisions together. That where none of us really knew how to do what we were doing. We knew how to do the advocacy work and the lawyering. We didn't know how to build and run an organization. And so we had to take advice. We had to know what we didn't know. We had to be eager to find that out. We had to be willing to learn both from before decisions are made and from our mistakes and grow and evolve from there. So that was a whole nother set of decisions. And, it was a little too exciting at times, but.
It was a good segue because one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which was on my mind. And when I thought about talking to you is that, you spent 24 years at the Shriver Center on poverty law, and you were really leading the fight for economic and racial justice, as you just talked about. And based upon what we have just gone through in our political process, which is we could spend days talking about, I guess, what changes did you see over time regarding how the government is addressing the underprivileged, and did this affect your approach to policy negotiation?
Oh, it has to. I mean, this stuff is intensely political. It's not partisan. You know, we're a 501c3. We cannot take sides in elections. But it's intensely political. You know, whether you get whether the Affordable Care Act is implemented in Illinois or not, you know, things like that. So the way that government has evolved is you think about it. In the 1960s, the President Johnson, less than two months after the assassination, in his first State of the Union message, announced a government-sponsored war on poverty. Can you imagine that now? It isn't just the fact that poverty is an important priority issue for the government to deal with. It's, you know, this belief in the capacity of government to do anything, anything competently. The sort of erosion of public trust in the role of government and the sort of reasons why we pay taxes and things like that. It's just very, very hard. It's hard to swim upstream against that. And the more ideological it gets, the harder it is. So in some ways, this can be a little easier the more local you are, because the politicians are a little bit less ideological. They have to sit across the kitchen table. Even conservative Republicans have sat there with people being laid off from the local factory, and they need unemployment insurance, and they can't figure out how to get health care, and they got to have some food, and they need the next job. So we were, you know, in the early days of that family care campaign, the governor was Republican and the Senate was in the hands of pretty hard right Republican leadership, and the House was Democratic. So you had to figure out how to do it with mixed government and try to build roll calls around it. The role of government in addressing a deep problem like poverty has gotten more challenging. We've had to get sort of better and better at it. And I've come to realize, again, working backwards from where you want to be, there's more involved here than just good advocacy or good lawyering, good organizing. There's a hearts and minds battle that we've been losing for years around the public support for this kind of thing for the role of government in doing it, for expanding health coverage, for making sure people have job training, for good public schools. There's a hearts and minds battle. And so, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I said, we have got to have communications capacity here. This can't continue to just be a boutique for lawyers, public interest lawyers. We have to engage in the hearts and minds battle. And so we have to have a communications capacity, marketing, your work. You have to figure out how to convince people about things, how to use the right words, right? And to learn from those professions about how you persuade, you know, large numbers of people who you're not going to talk to one-on-one.
So what's interesting,
I guess I wandered
me,
away from your question there.
Yeah, well, not really, but what's interesting to me is that unlike the roles that my brother and I played, where there was a lot of gray, in lawyering, it's black and white. You either win, you lose. Okay, you leave the courtroom, you've either won or lost. Right. So with that as sort of a construct, coming full circle, as you look back over your career through the rearview mirror, were there any decisions that you made that you might have done differently? And if so, what were those and how do you address those?
Yeah, well, looking back on it, I don't think that I was, you know, once the decision was made to go into sort of law reform and systemic change, bigger focused changes, I did not appreciate early enough on the value of what I call the outside game, the sort of people power, the organizing and media and message, right? I was too stuck in the just being a lawyer and being the one guy who can do all the work and change the world, right? I could sit in my cinder block office on the South Side and write briefs. You could win some stuff that way, and I don't regret that, but I do regret it. It was probably 20 years into my career before I really understood how, you know, the different things that you need to accomplish bigger, you know, bigger scale change, and the things that, you know, that affect the hearts and minds battle and the people power and the things that sway decision makers, other than just, you know, the logic of your facts and arguments. Because a lot of times that's pretty far down the list of what motivates a legislator to make a vote. So that's what I would, and that's what we have focused actually at the Shriver Center on, training public interest lawyers in these things, right? That training I never had, but sort of had to learn the hard way in the first half of my career. So we have a training called community lawyering. We have a training called racial justice, a racial justice institute, which is heavily about how do you deal with community leaders? How do you make sure that the work you're doing is in service to things they want and involves them in the advocacy? Because that increases the power of it, and it also sharpens the utility of the things that you win. You know, they actually do solve problems then.
Well, when you were at the Shriver Center and you were running that, did you ever jump to 30,000 feet and say, hey, look, you know, especially in Illinois, I mean, we are really challenged. Budgets are challenged. Things are getting worse. Did you ever think about engaging the private sector to address poverty?
Oh, sure. We do that all the time. In the first instance, as allies in, you know, the public policy fights, you know, getting support from in that family care campaign, we had the support of Blue Cross Blue Shield. We had the support of the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. But those were, you know, those were sort of advocacy campaigns in themselves to get them to actively support that. But also, you have to do that to financially support an organization like the Shriver Center. So you have to appeal to corporations and individuals and major donors. And it can't just be philanthropy or foundations. And then we work closely with the bar, the organized bar lawyers. We, you know, whenever there's an opportunity to work with a corporate partner on a campaign like expanding broadband, expanding access to food, things like that. Yeah, absolutely. So we've worked with banks on a lot of things.
I think what I'm taking away from this is that it's as much marketing and strategy as it is lawyering. So, Paul and I will raise our hand if you ever need help. We're there to help you in the marketing and strategy.
Oh, good. Area.
So. So John, we really appreciate the time you spent today. I think that, you know, what I took away, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, your construct, your structure has really been built around your career and really starting with the end in mind and then working backwards to understand all the things you got to do to achieve that end.
Right.
Would that be an accurate sort of assessment?
Yes. And then I think one more thing. Is you'll burn out if you think you're going to end poverty, right? So you have to relish the victories you get, but also understand that the fight will always go on. And when you're done, you hand it off to someone else. The joy of it is the process and the collegiality and the victories you get along the way.
John, thank you. We really do appreciate your time today. Hopefully our listeners took away something of value for them. And until next week, this is John Kramer saying thanks for listening. And we appreciate, as always, our guests' involvement.
You've been listening to Insights Through the Rearview Mirror. Each week, we speak with interesting people, exploring their decision-making processes to understand how these change their lives. Check out our past guests at www.rearviewinsights.com and click on the link to listen on iTunes. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate us, and leave a comment. Until next Friday, this is John Kramer, wishing you insightful and successful decision-making.